Steve Ingham is one of the world's most successful performance scientists, having worked with over 1,000 elite athletes and provided pivotal input to gold medal winning performances for dozens of Olympians and world champions. He's pioneered new well-being strategies to enable athletes to break through previously unimagined limits by counterintuitive adoption of recovery science. I think you'll find not only is this a fascinating insight into how champions are supported, but there are many lessons which everyone can benefit from.
Hi, folks. Welcome to the Evolving Leader Podcast. Scott Allender here, along with my friend and a man who never makes the same mistake twice, but he is willing to make it five or six times, the one and only John Gomes. How are you feeling today, John?
Oh, well, as always, uplifted by your kind introductions. But seriously, I am feeling very positive today because we've got an old friend joining us on our show today, somebody who's going to really give us some exciting, insightful ideas and observations. So I'm feeling great. How are you feeling, Scott?
Feeling similar. I'm feeling really, really good, actually. Feeling energized. I've been actually training hard the past 3 months. I have no idea exactly, but I've been burning up some fat and adding back some muscle. And I'm sharing this with you as a not-so-veiled attempt to earn the respect of our guest today, Dr. Steve Ingham. Dr. Ingham is one of the world's leading applied sports scientists. He has provided support to over 1,000 athletes, of which over 200 have achieved world or Olympic medal success, including some of the world's greatest athletes, such as Dame Jessica Ennis Hill, Sir Steve Redgrave, and Sir Matthew Pinsent. Steve has also coached athletes to Olympic medal winning success. Steve worked with the British Olympic Association from 1998 to 2004, where he was senior sports physiologist and sports science manager, and at the English Institute of Sport from 2004 to 2016, where he was head of physiology and later the director of science and technical development, leading a team of 200 scientists in support of Team Great Britain and Paralympics Great Britain. Steve holds a BSc, a PhD, and is a fellow of the British Association of Sport and Exercise Sciences. Steve is also the author of the best-selling How to Support a Champion, The Art of Applying Science to the Elite Athlete, as well as his newest book, The First Hurdle. And John, I know you worked with Steve too, the results of which are clearly indeterminate. Steve, welcome to The Evolving Leader.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, dear. I don't think Steve can have any responsibility for anything that you see in my performance. But there you go. Steve, welcome to the show. Can we start with an overview of your career? I know we've given you a very, quite a fulsome description of some of the highlights, but let's kind of bring that to life with some of the experiences that you've had.
Okay, so I suppose my it all starts being a frustrated athlete of wanting to try and run fast. I was a relatively rubbish 100 meter sprinter. That's probably the start point of where I got curious about human performance. So thinking, okay, I'm quite good. Oh, those guys are better than me. Okay. There's a lot of people that are a lot faster than me. And then thinking, why? Why are they better? And being inspired by the various gold medalists you would have seen at various Olympics, of thinking, okay, so what makes the difference between the gold and the silver? And then I met a man called Colin Clegg who very much showed me that you can understand this, and that got me curious. And it just propelled me to want to know more and more about human performance from a physiology, psychology, from the things that we eat, the things, the way that we think. And so I then went on to study it. And then that was at degree level. And I suppose I came out of my studies at a point when, luckily, Britain was at the pit of despair of the Atlanta Games. And we were an embarrassment, I suppose, that there was only one gold medal, the Atlanta Olympics, Redgrave and Pinsent, who I went on to work with. And at that point, there was no system. So a job working with athletes just didn't exist. But I was fortunate enough to be one of 10 sports scientists in the UK in 1996. And And then I suppose I've just ridden this particular wave of working with people. And the British rowing team, British athletics team, coordinating and managing and delivering that growth of the support systems that sit behind every champion athlete these days, of being able to guide people through that has been, I guess, the body of my career. The big part of this has been that we have no textbook for it. There's no manual for being the very best in the world at a certain thing. If you put Olympic performance into a major scientific research database, that it would return very little. And even then, people get to the top of the mountain in a very different way. And so previously, people had tried to put research and bolt it onto an elite athlete and try to experiment on them, take bits of muscle so they could put it under a microscope. And I just thought, that doesn't sound constructive. I would like to do this a different way of being somebody that they can trust, somebody that they can talk to, somebody that they can take counsel with, whether it's their doubts, whether they're training, and find and discover and test and learn new ways of being able to grow, to learn, to adapt. And I suppose the big pivot point was when we started to really apply science to the elite athlete in the late 90s, when you've got a step change from people who are probably going to get on the Olympic podium anyway, whether you've got support teams behind them. And then you've got a bunch of other people that wouldn't have gotten to the Olympic podium, and a systematic support, this idea of trusted partners learning and adapting together, that can mean that somebody who might have got eighth place got a bronze, or somebody who might have got fifth place can actually win the thing. And that has been propelled by the London Games, obviously in 2012, and sustained performance, which I think is an even more interesting topic into Rio and recently Tokyo.
And it's worth just kind of reflecting on the fact that this progression from that dismal performance back in the mid-90s to where we are today, and the last three Olympics particularly, where Team GB has been in the top three, four places, is quite astounding, really. And of course, everybody points to the lottery funding, but money isn't everything. I mean, there are a lot of countries with a lot of money and lots of people, but it's this systematized approach, which might come as a surprise to people, just about what the gap was in terms of applying the science of psychology and sports science and physiology, that what you've done. And I suppose I'd like to start with probably one of the most incredible accomplishments that you made personally as a young sports scientist when you started your career working with the British Olympic rowing team. And as you say, that was the era of Steve Redgrave and Matthew Pinsent, who dominated the sports in the 90s. But you weren't working with those guys. You didn't get to work with them initially. You got to work with the also-rans, the people that stood no chance of potentially, because their best placing in international competition, as I recall up to that point, had been last place consistently. And you had 18 months to do something about it. Can you tell us what happened and how you did it?
Yeah, I think that there are two stories there within the British rowing team, is that you got on the juggernaut with Redgrave and Pinsent and you didn't make a mistake. That was one version. you just did a great job in the background. It wasn't really until late on in that phase with Redgrave and Pinsent that they turn around and say, "What do you think?" It was 2 years of real bedded trust. But they were going to win. They were going to win whether I was there or not. And that's one side of it. But they had what I would call the hardware, the lung size, the lever length, the physiological gift, as well as probably hardwired in a mindset that was going to knock everything out of the way to make sure that they won. And that's not for everybody now. You've probably got a much more nuanced, individualized approach for a lot of athletes. And one of the examples in the late 90s was the men's eight crew. It's actually become relatively well known now under the saying, "Will it make the boat go faster?" And that was started really by a man called Martin McElroy, who was the coach. And it was his responsibility to try and pull together what was the leftovers in the nicest possible way, the bottom rung, the group at the bottom, the men's eight were going to be put together with the low end of the world-class program. So they were still outstanding athletes, but they weren't necessarily the top boats. And so you had people in the boat, Ben Hunt Davis, who's very well connected with that particular story, Lewis Attrell, Kieran West, Steve Trapmore, who now is a coach for the British rowing team. And you'd look at the physiology and just think, they're not going to win. They're not going to win. But they were doing things that were optimized for Redgrave and Pinson. They were doing training regimes. They were living, breathing a regime that wasn't suited to them. So what Martin, the coach, really set out to do was pull together a team to say, we are going to do whatever we can to try and have the best shot at winning. And what does that mean for your bit? So he had a very clear purpose of, we want to go and on a journey to see how far we can go with this crew. And so what that meant was that I had to park my pet projects, the sorts of things that I thought I might be able to land a scientific idea into their regime. And I had to think fundamentally about what they were training, what intensity they were doing, how they were resting, how they were recovering. And so then we started to reverse engineer and design a program of training and thinking and eating that gave them the best chance of adapting. And that's the key. They weren't in the place where they're on a par with an Olympic champion, but they had to improve and adapt at a rate that we hadn't seen before. So what did that mean for them, for example? The old regime was Redgrave and Pinson would go out on the water at 7 o'clock in the morning. They'd come back, have a quick breakfast. They would do some weight training. They would have another breakfast. Then they would go on the rowing machines and they would have lunch. And then they'd go and play golf or meet with sponsors or do work.
Scott likes the breakfast and golf part there.
Yeah. Well,
be careful. Don't hang around with 16 stone.
I'm halfway there.
Don't hang around with 16 stone athletes who are burning 6,000 calories a day. You need an elasticated waistband for that. What we had to do with these less physical specimens, if you like, was train morning, optimal nutrition, planned rest and recovery, optimizing that. So they had to mean that they were super organized and on it. Then back on the water, middle of the day with the optimized nutrition around that, some mental skills training in the afternoon, and then late session in the evening to maximize rest during the day to give them the chance to adapt. That's just an example. And they got some relatively quick results with that, where people who were bludgeoning at trying to improve their physical capability or their mental skills weren't in the right place, suddenly it started to escalate. And they went from seventh place, the World Championships, to second place within a year. And then a wonderful moment on the lake in Penrith in Sydney to actually clinch the Olympic gold medal against all the odds.
In 18 months.
Yeah.
So what led you, because, you know, that wasn't happening, as you say, at the time, the rest and renewal piece. So what led you to underpin your approach with that focus? And as I understand, I think that was a real advantage that for Jessica Enos Hill and her story. Can you tell us about that?
Well, and that's another example of where a constraints-led innovation effectively is what we're working with here. So Jess was the face of the Games in London 2012. For anyone who doesn't know Jess, any non-Brits that might not know, face of the Olympics, heptathlete, seven events, and six of those events are power events, over within 30 seconds, some of them over in the blink of an eye. So generally, the ones that do really well are power-based athletes. And then you've got this thing at the end, the 800 meters, So for the decathletes, they sort of trudge round, and it's quite painful to watch the dinosaur heart-sized humans trudging a 1500 meters. For the ladies, it's the 800 meters. And then we got this start to see this shift on a global level where it was deciding the event. So it wasn't just a nice to have at the end. It was actually something you could lose or win on. And so with physiology, it works this way, where if you train for one characteristic, such as strength, then you actually get physically worse in another area called endurance. If you bulk up with your in terms of muscle, that's not good for doing a marathon, for example. Equally, if you do lots of endurance training, you wither away the muscle in the nicest possible way, but you make your system much leaner and meaner because you've got to transport it over a longer distance. So you can't be super strong. So for heptathlete, you can't be super powerful and have endurance. So we had to try and work out a way of starting with that. And so we actually started with some of thinking about the event itself, 2 days worth of effort in the Olympic Stadium. And I asked a question, and often a lot of the innovation comes from asking good questions. Of what's it like to do an Olympic heptathlon? And Jess turned around and said, well, okay, it's obviously you've got to think about all the different events, but it's a bit of a drudge. I said, that's interesting. A drudge? What do you mean? She said, you've got to carry your bags about. You've got to make sure you've got different shoes for every event. You've got to try and get rest in the bowels of the stadium, which is not optimal. You've got to try and rest and recover and eat at the right time, hanging around between events. And so I said, that's interesting. So it could be that you get to the 800 meters, the final event, and you're standing on the start line and you're tired, not just because of the sport bit, but because of the event. I said, I think so. I said, okay, so could we design a program that gets you to that, the start line of the final event, where you're fresher than any other girl on the start line? And suddenly her eyes just lit up. I would love that. And so actually we were dealing with something that's relatively high risk in terms of playing around with an Olympic program, Olympic strategy, but it's high return. And so when you're in high risk, high return, you've got to take your time. You've got to test. You've got to do the analysis. You've got to trial stuff out. So this was 2004. We had this first conversation, the first time that Jess actually did her almost the pilot work for the Olympics in 2012 was 6 years before at the Commonwealth Games. And then we refined and we adapted and we changed it as you get closer. And then the last couple of years, you're not actually doing, or you shouldn't be doing too much. You're just stabilizing and developing the confidence in the regime. So yeah, that was as a really challenging case. But then 18 months later, Jess says, I'm pregnant. How do I come back from pregnancy? I was like, okay, now I'm a pregnancy advisor. So that's a different challenge altogether.
But I remember talking to you, you know, and it was 7 or 8 years ago, about one very small part of this this renewal approach that you took, where you had kind of studied, and because of the constraint, you know, and the fact that you couldn't, that the coach wouldn't let you kind of change an awful lot of things, you had to find really intelligent, smart ways of being able to create that objective or create that goal without meddling too much. And I remember you saying that you had noticed that if you brought her own pillow with her, she got just a few more minutes sleep every day. It was that kind of marginal gains thing that you had to figure out loads of those that then accumulated into giving the advantage.
Yeah, and I think there's a good example here where I would put an idea forward and they would say no. and again, and again, and again. And that really helps me start to get in touch with the demands that they're under. So taking the lesson from the men's eight back in the 90s, one of the big things that we did with Jess was just separate out some of the training, so she had more rest and recovery. But one example was, I would just ask questions, and I said, "How do you warm up for each of the 10 sessions you do per week?" And they said, "Well, we just jog around the track and just have a chat together." So, okay, that's interesting. Well, there's 6 minutes of jogging there. You do that 10 times per week. Could we manipulate or change that 6 minutes of jogging? And they said, well, okay, well, what's your idea? And I put them through, I put Jess through a full laboratory-based physiological test to find the level at which it could just provoke her physiology, her training. That, you know, that everyone will probably get to know this level where it's an exercise intensity that just starts to shut everyone up. everything goes a bit quiet. It's starting to pinch a bit.
Hmm.
And get Jess to do her 6 minute warm ups at that level. And they said, well, is that really going to work? And I said, I don't know, but I haven't got any other choice. So why don't we test it? Because we've got time. We've got time to see whether a small aspect of one of the events, we could nudge it along in an innovative way. It's proportionate to the overall goal. And it means that we know that you're not going to reduce the level of her high jump or her hurdles. And so this is context specific and big goal specific, rather than me just saying, well, I can turn you into a world-class 800 meter runner, but it'll sit at the expense of the other departments, if you like. But when I talk to other science researchers in sport, and they'll say 6 minutes, that doesn't do anything. I said, well, the applied reasoning behind it has to make sense, and we've got evidence over 24 month period that it nudges it along as you go. And so, you would never see that in a textbook. You'd never see that documented as an intervention that can improve your endurance fitness. But with very little alternative, that's something that applied. And one of the ideas that actually flew.
Yeah. I'd like to just try and take this in a slightly different direction for a couple of minutes in terms of how these ideas or how what you've learned here could be relevant to our listeners. Because I think particularly high achievers in any field tend to write off the idea of marginal gains, you know, it's small things like that, because they don't feel in the moment that they make a difference. And what you're saying is, no, that they actually have a cumulative effect that over a period of time leads to a very significant advantage. And what I think is helpful with that is that, you know, all the people that are listening here are time poor. Yeah, everybody is that's trying to do, you know, significant work. So rather than trying to make some grand gesture, trying to find smart ways of doing what you're doing, which is hacking stuff to find how you get that cumulative effect. Can you give us some thoughts about how we might do that, you know, from the things that you've learned that apply, ideas that might apply to the average person rather than athletes?
Just to step back a little bit from marginal gains, as a term, it's originated from cycling, British cycling, and it's worth just noting why it came up. That they were very keen on developing athletes that could drive the pedal crank very hard or for a sustained period of time, and really interested in reducing aerodynamic drag. Those two things. And those effectively are the massive gains areas. And if it didn't map to one of those, it didn't really get talked about. And so you can only really get marginal and into some of the detail if you're very clear on the massive gains, the areas that are the super priority, and be very, very disciplined in making sure that you're removing work that isn't distracting or isn't pulling you away from those key priority areas. So that's just worth recognizing. So the example with Jess is what actually I was doing was something that was quite marginal gainsy, that's a term. But what it was doing was protecting the massive areas. Mm. So we had to nudge something forward. And so we had a little bit of freedom to experiment, because what we're not doing is changing the hurdle technique. We're not trying to intervene in some of the massive point scoring areas. So that's worth recognizing, and getting super detailed, sophisticated, knowledgeable, and potentially experimental about some of those key massive areas. Because what I have seen is marginal gains philosophies going awry, where people are saying, we're changing the pencil, it's marginal gains. I'm being sarcastic, but where every change is justified because it's a marginal gain. And the schemes of work firing off left, right, and center mean that you're now not necessarily benefiting, because you're trying to manage hundreds of projects, and you're probably doing it really badly, as opposed to what's the one thing that's really going to lever big performance and change, some of which we've talked about, rest and recovery. But the one of the, before I answer your question, one of the paradoxes that I've seen with champion athletes, which is an interesting concept, is that when you first start working with them, when they're a bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, talented, but hungry teenager, for example, they typically, I'm broad brush statements here, but they typically are very open-minded. And so they will lap it up. And so your responsibility there is to be clear. This is the priority for you. This is what you need to be doing. It's a great time to get good habits in, sleeping habits, nutrition habits in. When somebody wins something, or when they start to become that high achiever, what we do see typically is a discerning view of what they should include in their program. So what might have got you to European champion might not get you to world champion, but because you became European champion, you're now crystallizing that regime and that order and structure of the things that got you there aren't necessarily what's going to get you further. Mm-hmm. And again, world champion or serial Olympic gold medalist, well, I'll just do what I did before, but competitors change, you age, the stimulus that's going to provoke your adaptation, your fitness, will shift. So one of the key aspects that we do now much more rigorously is to instill a good habit that protects against that, which is performance debriefing. So you work with the 18-year-old to instill performance debriefing so that it unearths areas that they feel are important. And so if there's one thing that you want them to be closed-minded on, they're going to be, I'm doing my performance debrief because that is a regime that helps me propel each time. And so from a performance debrief, you will surface a couple of key areas that you would look to nudge or to test or to trial. And I think that in itself offers an opportunity for a lot of leaders to think, what could we trial? What could we test? What could we put in one group and ask them to do something differently? And compare that and contrast that with another group. And so you're looking to see how it feels, what the productivity might be, the return on investment, if you like. And so if people are afraid to just suddenly change something, put some testing in place, put some review and some assessment in place to try it, give it a go.
So let's stay with us in the organizational context and the work that you do with leaders, as you apply these sort of systematic scientific approaches with sort of deep diving into the human needs and motivations of people in the organization in order to unveil and challenge businesses to think differently about how they deliver personal and organizational performance. Can you paint us a picture of what this looks like in an organizational setting?
Yeah, there are some key characteristics of teams that seem to outstrip the expected performance levels, and equally some almost reverse of teams that underperform. And typically when we've looked at the performance, when you start to sort of take medals out of it, you look at how productive that team has been, what's the quality of the progress that they're making, then it's very rare that it's individual characteristics. You know, it's just a star performer. It's very rare that it's intellect. And one of the performance directors, household name performance director, said to me after the Beijing Olympics, which came back covered in gold medals, super successful, fourth on the medal table, that which was the target for the London Games 4 years later, and said, okay, we've got a bunch of people here, scientists, that they know their stuff, they don't know how to work with people. And so that's what we need. And it would have been really lovely if I could have said, well, we could just change the protocols we're using, the therapy methods, the way that people are eating, design diet plans. But it was all about communication. It was all about trust. It was all about empathy. And these areas that, again, to quote the performance director at the time, I would take 20% less of IQ for just a 10% improvement in EQ. Mm-hmm. And to me, that was damning of our service provision. We couldn't really look ourselves in the mirror just thinking, we don't know how to work with these people. We can't bring our knowledge to life. So that set us off on a bit of a mission to learn from other high-performance industries such as the SAS or NASA, which have these spike movements. You're preparing, and then you go, a bit like the Olympics. But equally from industries that have to perform every day, ambulance workers, air traffic control. And we saw that the same characteristics that separated of the best teams in high-performance sport were the same characteristics that they train because it saves lives. and that was trust, empathy, collective accountability. You know, bear in mind, I'm a scientist. I want to talk about skin suits and clever beetroot juice and training regimes. But now I'm thinking empathy is a unit of performance. And if we don't culture empathy within teams, if we don't start to understand how we do that, then we are leaving performance on the table. It means that we're ignoring that area, and so shift to that space. And I've been humbled to spend immersively the last 5 years working with businesses, because I hear the same conversations about team dynamics, and I feel quite strongly that high performance teams doesn't sit in an individual responsibility. It sits between people. And there are ways in which you can nurture that. It's not easy. It's not comfortable. Primarily because, as I say, if you just gave people a new standard operating procedure, they go, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. If you say to somebody, we need to work on your body language, now suddenly someone's getting a bit emotional about this. But there are research studies that show how we turn up and work in a team, how we engage with each other, is infectious, and we can deteriorate performance by not getting in the right space for us to perform when it matters. And so why wouldn't we do that?
So given that shift from Beijing, you know, firstly getting that mirror held up to the team's way of showing up, what have you learned personally in how to do that for yourself? With the people that you work with, what did it force in you, in terms of self awareness and you know the way in which you have to think about setting your intent for all the interactions you have? What have you done and learned in that respect?
Are you asking me for some specific examples about my own performance, or helping other people too?
No, you. How did that? Because it sounds like you had a fairly profound kind of wake up about the significance of that. And as an expert and as somebody who's really, really deeply mined the territory from a science point of view, this is another dimension for you. And I'm just interested in what that how that shifted your mindset and approach?
I could go back through the examples, and I'll bounce through a few of these. But before I stood there with Redgrave towering down and looking at me, I'd done my prep. I had spoken to people before who had worked with him and heard that he was this quite intense character, etc. And I heard a comment, "The trouble is they don't listen to you." This is 1998. I'm 24 years old, and he's a four-time Olympic gold medalist. I'm thinking, why would he want to listen to me? So I went in with a very different mindset to that conversation of thinking, you know, I just want to journey with this guy. I want to learn from him. So I was probably already on the front foot in this area. One significant experience working with his partner in crime, Matthew Pinson, a few years later. Actually, it's the 20th anniversary of this occasion with James Cracknell, the two of them working together, and they were doing two world championship finals in 2 hours. And my job was to work the physiology out, back to recovery. And because I got on quite well with them, and I thought, oh, we've been through this. Oh, you know, maybe I'll just ask a few questions. And I said to Matt, as an example question, why is it that, well, you're one of the tallest, you've got one of the longest lever lengths, but you've got one of the shortest stroke lengths? And he sort of bluffed an answer and said, oh, it doesn't matter necessarily what you do, as long as it's consistent. I was like, yeah, okay. And then I asked him a question, and I wrote about this in How to Support Champions, so this is not the first time I've aired this, but I asked Matt, why is it that for 10 years you've won nearly every race, but when you don't win, you come fourth? And he bit. He bit back. Hmm. He said, "Did you get back in your box, scientist? It's not all just about numbers. It's about performing. You've got to understand it from our point of view. It just didn't happen on the day." And ruffled his feathers. And I thought, oh dear, curled up in a fetal position for a couple of weeks. Fast forward to the second final, Matt and James normally lead the race out from the start, but they were coming fourth all the way through, and they inched their way forward and they won by a matchbox. And Matt came up to me afterwards and said, I thought about you during the race. I said, you don't want to be thinking about me during the race. You want to be thinking about rowing backwards with a paddle. And he said, no, I thought about what you said back at that training camp a few months ago. And I vowed that if I weren't a silver medal, it would be the hardest earned silver medal I've ever won. I was like, God, I just asked a question, and I hadn't quite anticipated that would manifest itself in an Olympic race. He also said the same after the Olympic final in Athens. And then I just thought, okay, I've got to be much more cognizant and prepared when I go into moments like that, that I'm intentional, I'm in the right mindset to be able to propel people forward. And if I'm not, then what am I going to do to get me in the right mindset? And that might be sitting in my car for 5 minutes playing happy music, or taking a moment just to collect my thoughts, or to speak to my children, or whatever it might be to get into that place. And we have this idea of a simple single mantra or embodied image that you think about when you want to perform at your best. And that could be a sales pitch. That could be the Olympic final. Because if you ask an athlete on the start line, your hurdle technique, lift your knee up, don't forget to move your arm this way, don't forget to lift your eyes up, then it gets complicated. But if you have a simple single image, then it's very easy to embody that. And so for us in that moment at the Olympics, when an athlete's looking for you for guidance, inspiration, or facts and figures, that we have a similar feeling, we have a similar sense. Sometimes that could be that we just want to sit in the shadows, or that we, this is a bit cheesy, but I'll share one of mine with you that I stole from a psychologist at an Olympic Games, of being like a samurai. I'm sharing this reluctantly because please don't think I'm dressing up some sort of weird pajamas, whatever it might be. But if I'm thinking as a samurai, then I'm in the background. I'm not in the way. I'm in the shadows. But if I need to act, I step forward and I act decisively, and then I step back. That was one example of an image that, in the moment for me, really helps me.
If you're new to the Evolving Leader podcast, please subscribe to us on your favorite platform. We have many more thought-provoking and inspiring guests coming up this season that you won't want to miss. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, please leave us a review. Thanks for listening.
Could we come back to the rest and renewal and recovery piece? Because so many leaders, you know, they wear burnout almost as a badge of honor, as evidence that, you know, they're working really hard and doing all the right things. And sometimes when they get asked, how do you do it all, even, they say, well, I don't sleep, right? And then it just feels like an implosion waiting to happen. So applying what you've applied to the athlete experience for their performance, what might be some practical advice you could give to a leader who's listening right now for their own recovery?
We have a habit of doing this in sports performance teams, so not the non-athlete groups, the coaches, first in the car park, last to leave. And this is not... it is very present in sports performance, even though the thinking of overtraining an athlete, of simply you are not getting return from your work now, means that you have to review your practice. There's with athletes, I think there's a parallel that I think is useful, where a bit of work will get you fitter, a bit more work will get you fitter still. Fully dedicated, full-time training will get you very fit. And so they draw an association between that work and their development. And every elite athlete has grafted for the accomplishments that they've created. I would imagine for most high achievers, that's true. It's the extra mile that they've gone. It's the discretionary effort. It's the fact that when they were off task, they were thinking about an idea. They might have been texting somebody to say, what about this? And then that led to a breakthrough. And so you get this reinforcement. What I hear and see in executive teams is that it's not necessarily the graft, it's the quality of the decision making that is key. And so for an athlete, it's not necessarily the 100 hours that they're putting in each month. It's more to do with how they're delivering some of the top race pace sessions, if you like, to draw the parallel. So for an executive who might have to almost rely on their brain power to be able to make those split decisions, 49-51 decisions, where they're weighing up the pros and the cons that'll have ramifications for a whole tribe of people, then I think you're in a space of what do I need to do to be in a place to make that decision. So what I see typically, and this is how I would approach the problem, is getting a handle on when those decisions start to deteriorate. Now, typically, for what we know for some of the brain-based sports, is that you would start to chop up some of the practice and the training. And so what I see people doing in work is doing 5-hour meetings, 10-hour Zooms nowadays, where the prefrontal cortex is exhausted from the effort and the work. And so very simply asking the question, if we were performance focused, how would we structure our day is a critical question. I think we could get into sleep. I'll put that one as an area that is worth perhaps exploring, but there are two key areas that I think are, sleep included, that are accumulative. If you start doing them, you'll benefit, and then you'll have a little bit more energy to be able to do that again. And the two are sleep and exercise. And protecting those areas. And what we know from those sports that are high cognitive load, what we know from the research work around memory champions, is that a lot of the ability is developed overnight. And so it's hardwired in and learned and connected. And so if you're depriving that, then you're doing effectively what our rowers were doing previously, where they're not recovering, they're not allowing the adaptation to occur. So Mihai Csikszentmihalyi has done a lot of work in this area, where you've got your immersion in the work. That's the hard work, that's the training, that's the meeting. You've then got incubation, excuse me, your incubation, where you've got time off task to let it manifest for a physical adaptation as you're building new proteins, building new muscle. And then you've got inspiration, where effectively you've got adaptation and you've got that improvement. You've got the hardwired cognitive skill in place. It's an area that I think everyone will be familiar with, but using exercise to enhance your day is something that I just don't see people doing nearly enough of. When it's actually either providing a break, it's setting you up for stress management during the day, or it's resetting from a stressful day too, where it's just huge capability improvement that you would do if you were performance focused.
As we come to the end of our time, I'm really interested in your thoughts about the future. And you know, because you're also research based, you must be seeing an awful lot of things in neuroscience, in the effective sciences, in interoception, a whole bunch of areas that are all converging. What do you think the next kind of set of frontiers are for performance development? What are we going to be hearing about and seeing in the coming years?
There's certainly the areas of neuroscience and understanding how we perform is an untapped area. The plasticity of the brain, I think, is only really just starting to come into the realization. In the same way that if we lift heavy weights, the plasticity of our muscle is high. If we are allowing and creating conditions for optimal learning, then we're seeing big changes in brain center development. A good example that is relatively well known, but I think it's underappreciated because it's not as tangible, is meditative active work. For example, meditation will develop a certain aspect of the brain, and you will literally have more gray matter in that part of the brain. In the same way that London taxi drivers have their brain scanned and can see geographical location-based centers of the brain has developed, we can see that your ability to focus, again, has developed from meditative action. So I think as we're starting to understand how our brains adapt over time, the possibilities of human performance, I think, start to look very different. And probably will start to move on a par with the physical training aspect. And part of that will be us knocking down barriers around mental health. That if I'm ill, and we're all very aware of viral illnesses at the moment, if I'm ill and I go into the office, I'm an unsociable person to have around. People are saying, you shouldn't be here for us, but for also for you. And I think that given that we are cyclical animals, we have highs and lows, we have this nature of being, of have periods of on and off, that we'll recognize and understand that when perhaps our mood might drop, then we need to be more supportive of that. People will go through phases and transitions through life. But if we're thinking about doing this well, we're thinking about creating good, healthy, sustainable performance environments, that's how we'll look after our people.
Mm. I love that. Makes a lot of sense. Steve, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been incredibly insightful.
My pleasure.
Yeah, Steve, I knew it would be great. We could probably have another show with you at some time in the future, and maybe bring some athletes along into the conversation,
yeah.
Which could be fun, ones that have sworn at you a lot.
Yeah, there's a few of those. Yeah,
yeah. But
blood, sweat, and tears, all of those of which I can put in an analyzer.
Excellent. Well, it's lovely to see you, and continued success in supporting champions, because it's very exciting work you're doing, and I know you've made huge progress both in the sports world, but also now increasingly in the business world as well, in terms of taking those ideas. So thank you so much for your time today, and hopefully we'll see you in the future.
Great to connect. Thanks, guys.
Until next time, the world is evolving. Are you?